Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
This Hedge School series of podcasts is brought to you by History Ireland Magazine and the Wardwell Group. For more information or to subscribe, visit historyireland.com. Greetings, history lovers, and welcome to the latest History Ireland Head School. This is Tommy Graham, editor of History Ireland. And today we're looking at the propaganda war in the revolutionary decade. According to British Prime Minister David Lloyd George, Irish nationalists were, quote, natural propagandists, unquote. How accurate was this description? How did they breach what Arthur Griffith called the, quote, paper wall, unquote, of British news coverage? How important was the new medium of film? And what was the role of women as both the disseminators and objects of propaganda? So to address these and other questions, I'm joined by Ciara Chambers, Head of Screen Media at University College Cork, Dara Gannon, Arts and Humanities Research Council Fellow at Queen's University Belfast, and more importantly, commissioning editor of The Split, From Treaty to Civil War, 1921 to 23, the fourth of History Ireland's special supplements tracking the decade of centenaries. Maurice Walsh, who lectures in history at Goldsmiths College, University of London. And finally, Margaret Ward, honorary senior lecturer in history at Queen's University, Belfast. And this Hedge School is supported by the Department of Tourism, Culture, Arts, Gaeltacht, Sport and Media, under the Decade of Centenaries 2012 to 2023 initiative. Now, before we look at propaganda in the Irish context, Maurice Walsh, I want to go to you just for a general look at this. To what extent did people, both elites and the general public, understand the concept of propaganda? I'm thinking in particular in the context of the Great War.
So yeah, there was a huge understanding. Propaganda really, I think, came into its own as a concept during the First World War. And for many, including on the German side, it was something that Britain had mastered. So after the war, you had General Ludendorff saying that Germany had been subject to a moral blockade. And even Hitler, when he comes to write Mein Kampf, is talking about how Germany wouldn't have lost the war except for the wicked British propaganda. And this combination of censorship, of a term that came in at that time, doctoring the news, was really perfected during the First World War, so that by the end of the First World War, this major propaganda effort, mainly in Britain, but also from the United States, had become the subject of a big debate among commentators, who worried that that the press, rather than being an agent of truth-telling, had now become a menace to democracy because of all this doctoring of the news. And you have this phrase that Walter Lippmann, the American writer, came up with after the war, when he wrote a series of books all about the dangers of propaganda and democracy. And he came up with this idea of the manufacture of consent. And consent for the war had been manufactured by censorship and propaganda. There's a famous moment where Lloyd George has breakfast with the editor of the Manchester Guardian, C.P. Scott, late on in the war. And he says to Scott, well, if everybody really knew what was going on the Western Front, this war would have to stop. But of course, they won't know because the correspondents won't write it. And so the whole of the British press mobilized for this propaganda effort, largely. And afterwards, there was a whole, it generated a huge suspicion about the press. An argument actually that was, I argue, very crucial to when the coverage of Ireland began, because this whole debate about whether you can trust the press, I think, influenced some of the coverage of Ireland. So when Lloyd George talks about the Irish being natural propagandists, he's merely covering over what was actually a very concerted development of a technique during that First World War.
So, Maris, what you're suggesting then is that the very success of the British in the propaganda area rebounded upon them when it came to Ireland.
Yes. So, I mean, part of that success, we know that the First World War started out as a war of empires, but it unleashed this war of nationalisms against empires. So, for instance, in comparison to Ireland, all over Central Europe, as the Austro-Hungarian Empire crumbled, you had new nations making their case and making their case very similar to Ireland. And so suddenly all of the stratagems of propaganda to appeal to various nationalisms, and that was a key part of it, creating a big narrative, then came back to bite them because, of course, these national movements in Ireland, but also elsewhere, were themselves able to create a narrative and to take part in the same game. And also, so throughout the First World War, Sinn Féin and Arthur Griffith, one of their main aims was to confound British atrocity propaganda. And Griffith had a quote about that the factory for manufacturing German atrocities was a pub in Fleet Street. And he wasn't very far wrong at that. And Lord Northcliffe, of course, owner of the Daily Mail, the man who started the Daily Mail in a way completely changed mass journalism, was again a key propagandist during the First World War. And yet some of these techniques were taken, and we'll come on to this, of course, later, were taken by the people who were supposed to be controlled by them.
Now, Margaret, I just want to talk to you about the suffrage movement, because that was the big agitation, particularly just before the First World War. What role did propaganda play in that, and what lessons were there for what would later happen in Ireland?
I think what's extraordinary about the few years before the First World War and the suffrage campaign is how, after decades of women bringing petitions to the House of Commons to have the vote and nothing ever happening, and people really not knowing about it, and women being more or less invisible from political and public life, within a couple of years of the Women's Social and Political Union being set up, the militant suffrage movement, Mrs. Pankhurst becomes the most famous woman in Britain, and in fact becomes a global figure, because the suffrage movement decides to take it to the public, to be extremely visible, to try and explain to the general public why it for women to have the vote. So they do things like heckle politicians in an extremely militant way, stopping politicians really from being able to speak in public. They have these massive pageants, for example, Hyde Park in 1910, where they have women from all over the world, particularly associated with the empire. So places like New Zealand, where women have already gained the vote, but you have Australia, South Africa, India, you have this enormous procession of women from around the world asking for the vote. You have the way they adopted the colours, the green, the white, the purple. People now think those are the colours of suffrage globally, but that they were the colours of the English suffrage movement, which managed to convince people really that this was the colours of suffrage everywhere. You had Sylvia Pankhurst as an artist designing all of these things. You had women with poster parades bringing, again, the message to the people of why women wanted the vote. And what they specifically did, I think, is to break down what, you know, that paper wall, the fact that newspapers had never seen women worthy of coverage, hadn't written about them until they start becoming militant. And then you have enormous amounts now of newsreel footage. If you want to look at suffrage, you can see all the different pageantry. And also when women start to send delegations, for example, to Westminster, under very badly treated by the police. Black Friday in 1910, when women are physically assaulted, sexually assaulted. There are all sorts of photographs of that. And I think that shocked a lot of the public and started to bring more sympathy to the women's cause. So I think that they really understood the role of propaganda and the role of getting your message across in every kind of medium that you could.
Now, Margaret, you've mentioned a newsreel here, and that brings me on to the next one. You know, film was the new kid on the block as a medium. Ciara, to what extent were Irish audience familiar with film at this stage?
Well, look, film was already very popular. Cinema going was a popular pastime. And interestingly, the cinema programme was quite different to one we might expect now. It had a main film, perhaps a secondary film. It had information films, newsreels, cartoons. So this is a place where people are getting the only form of moving image news available, because this is the era before television. And of course, much of this news is propagandistic and would have been recognised as so. So it had been acknowledged during the war, of course, that film could be a very popular and useful propaganda tool. And it was even suspected that what was shown in cinemas could have a direct effect on troops through letters from home from cinema patrons who had been watching morale-boosting films. So Morris has already mentioned how the press was mobilised for the war effort. Cinema was mobilised in similar ways, and it was censored and constructed in ways that was optimistic in terms of the notion of boosting morale for cinema patrons. But there was an acknowledgement here that, again, there was something quite constructed and perhaps problematic about this. So there were debates in the trade press by the end of the war about how film and newsreels in particular could be used as persuasive tools. And this is a point where audiences are perhaps starting to become a little bit more sophisticated in their response to some of these images. The Battle of the Somme, for example, was supposed to be this dramatic, thrilling piece of morale-boosting propaganda, but it divided cinema owners. So there was one exhibitor in London, for example, who said, "This is a place of entertainment." He put a sign up outside his cinema. "This is a place of entertainment, not a chamber of horrors. We will not be showing the Battle of the Somme film." So it's interesting to chart some of those responses. Perhaps before World War I, audiences were a little bit more naive, and newsreels in particular could substitute one location for another. They used library footage. They sometimes were very misleading in what they showed to the general public. But by the end of World War I, audiences were starting to question what they would see in the cinemas.
Ciara, just moving back to non-fiction film, right? Because the Caelum were already producing films with Irish themes. So how used were Irish audiences seeing themselves depicted, however inaccurately, you know, on film, on the screen?
Well, it's interesting at this stage because there weren't really a lot of sustained Irish, there wasn't a great deal of sustained local Irish production. But interestingly, and particularly with the newsreels, there were local newsreels that were produced. One early example is the Yall Gazette. So two cinema owners in Yall filmed local events and showed it in their cinema. And this was a really good way of getting cinema patrons to one cinema over another if they thought they would actually see themselves on screen. But there was, of course, the Film Company of Ireland producing Irish films at this stage. It was very short-lived, unfortunately, but some of those films were even shown to American audiences. And there's an interesting example of the Republican Loan film, and maybe we might come back to that later, because it's a piece of Irish propaganda which was unusual at this stage. So audiences were very used to seeing British newsreels on the screen, for example, or British and American films. They weren't as used to seeing images that were produced in Ireland. But a lot of the British newsreels, of course, covered Irish stories, and they covered Irish stories for both Irish audiences and British audiences. And these newsreels had a very pro-British agenda. So audiences in Ireland were used to seeing events depicted on screen that they knew unfolded very differently on the ground than the way they were shown in the cinema. So audiences would have acknowledged that these British newsreels were really problematic in reporting on events happening in Ireland, particularly during the War of Independence and the Civil War.
Okay, I will come back to that one actually, Ciara. But Dara, I want to move on to you now, and just to address Lloyd George's observation, were the Irish natural propagandists? I mean, how did they go up against this considerable British propaganda machine?
I think Lloyd George's kind of aphorism that the Irish were natural propagandists is historically grounded. But at the same time, we need to look at this idea of propaganda as an evolution, especially in this post-war period. And Morris is very clearly outlined the development of propaganda and its effects. But I think I'm going back in a way to what Patrick Pearce talked about when he said that Irish nationalists, by contrast to Lloyd George, he said that they were politicians by accident. So in a way, you have Pearce and Lloyd George speaking to two ends of the spectrum in terms of the acuity of Irish propaganda. I think Great Britain itself serves as a very interesting litmus test for this this theory or this concept, and Irish nationalism in Great Britain in particular after the First World War. It's important to bear in mind two things that have changed after the First World War. By virtue of setting up Dáil Éireann in Dublin at the Mansion House and removing Irish representation from Westminster, Irish nationalists have effectively stripped their possibility of promoting Irish nationalism at Westminster itself. The idea of propagating the Irish cause at Westminster, most clearly through the position of the Irish Parliamentary Party in the half century before that, was now removed. So there was a political vacuum to promote Irish nationalism in Great Britain at the heart of empire. There's also the case, the context, if you will, that after the First World War, the general consensus seemed to be that there was a boredom with the Irish question. We have to remember, of course, that British policymakers, the British public at large, had been engaged in this prolonged debate over the Third Home Rule Bill between 1912 and 1914. And of course, when the First World War transpired, that just completely removed the Irish question from the agenda. And there was a reluctance, there was an inertia, perhaps even an indifference to going back to the dreary steep hills of Tyrone and Fermanagh, as Churchill once said. So I think Irish nationalists in Great Britain have a particular role, a strategic role to fulfil in this post-war era. And in many ways, they mark the evolution from politicians by accident, as Pearce described them, to natural propagandists, as Lloyd George would describe them. So, for example, if you look at the main Irish nationalist movement in British centres after the First World War, the Irish Self-Determination League of Great Britain, it was dominated by Gaelic revivalists, people like Art O'Brien in London, most clearly, who basically advocated for an Irish-Ireland version of Irish nationalism, in which second and third generation Irish men and women were encouraged to speak the Irish language as a means of demonstrating their citizenship, their nationality, and their support for the Republic. And
Dara, can I just cut across you there? Right? Is there not a supreme irony there? Because I'm assuming that the very success of the Irish propaganda whole campaign was because it was in English and it gave it a worldwide audience. So is there a twist in that one?
There's certainly tensions there in terms of the kind of the espousal of an Irish Ireland view of the world. And of course, Sinn Féin, this idea of ourselves alone, captures that very eloquently. But at the same time, they have to be kind of international. They have to speak to English-speaking audiences. And in many ways, Irish nationalists, I think, in Great Britain, marked that evolution. So the Irish Self-Determination League start off with this idea, you must speak the Irish language to become an Irish citizen, to be truly considered an Irish nationalist. And this is met with disdain by second and third generation Irishmen and women. You know, you've got people with Cockney, Glaswegian, Scouse accents trying to negotiate the slippages of Gaeilge, and this is met with disdain, and to the extent that of 300,000 Irish-born men and women in Wales in 1921, there's only 3,000 members of the Irish Self-Determination League. So this is a failure, this kind of Irish language-inspired nationalist movement. However, if you fast forward to 1920 and 1921, you see this evolution of Irish nationalist propaganda, most clearly framed by, let's say, the Terence McSweeney hunger strike in London in August, between August and October of 1920, wherein the Irish Self-Determination League essentially used McSweeney's hunger strike and ultimate death to kind of propagate a view of Irish nationalism as religious, spiritual. So they create handbills, they provide posters, which all suggest this idea of being in this religious moment. The funeral of McSweeney in London itself is a great propaganda success in late October 1920, when you've got thousands of Irish men and women marching, in kind of very hushed tones. And this is captured by the British media, this sense of religious moment, which is cultivated by Irish nationalists in the print media, in the visual media, as Ciara has alluded to, and also in terms of coordinating Irish nationalists during that period. So I would argue that there's this evolution from politicians by accident to natural propagandists. And we should look at this period as not a finite representation propaganda, but as a developmental period, a period of gestation.
Okay, just on that point, I just want to go back to this before we, because we're going to move on to the discussion, back to you, Margaret, right, about the immediate post-1916 era, because obviously a lot of the men are in jail. Some of them have been executed. Just talk to me about the role of women in the post-1916 situation.
Yeah, well, there are, various things to say about the women, but one the context, of course, is the fact that the First World War is still going on, and you've got censorship, you've got the Defence of the Realm Act, so it's very difficult for propagandists on the Irish side to actually put out the kind of message that they would want to. So people, globally aren't quite sure what is this Sinn Féin rebellion, for example, and they can't talk about that in the way that they would want to. So, for example, so they use periodicals that wouldn't have seemed particularly subversive, and Catholic Bulletin, and the edition of that in December 1916 with its photographs of the women, the widows of 1916, because they couldn't look politically at what was happening, what they were able to do was to look at the home life of the men who had been executed. So they were trying to develop this positive picture of ordinary people, possibly even saintly people, who had gone out to defy British rule in Ireland because of these idealistic notions, by putting it, transposing it onto the women and the children they had left behind. You also have, before that, for example, reporters from the States, say the Chicago World, and that very famous photograph of Grace Plunkett in June 1916, and people had heard about the midnight wedding of Grace and James Plunkett before his execution. Who was this young woman who would do such a thing? And then there's this photo of her wearing white, not in widow's weeds, and holding a kitten, a very kind of soft portrait of a woman. So you've got these kind of not conflicting, but different images of women who are grieving, who are suffering. At the same time, you've got the women of Cumann na mBan now determined to keep up the resistance, particularly as so many men are now imprisoned. And you have very famous times when the women from the suffrage, labour and republican movements come together, like with Lá na mBan, the Women's Day Against Conscription. So you have this developing resistance by the women on the ground, the memorial masses for the men who've been executed, and using, as already been said, the Catholicism and the ritual Catholicism to construct this very Irish notion of resistance. And I think you can see how they juxtapose the Irish Catholic movement, I think, to the British Protestant oppressor. And I think that starts to come out very much, maybe not necessarily because that's what they meant, but because they're using the kinds of rituals that people are familiar with. People would say the rosary, would kneel down outside the jail gates as people are being executed to support the prisoners, etc. But those are the kinds of images that start to come out from Ireland at this time.
Now, how important was the use of photographs in all of this, Margaret?
I think that this is really important because For example, the pictures of the widows that are contained in the Catholic Bulletin, they are then used and subverted, if you like, that the photos are then taken and used as propaganda. And, you know, that you see so much of it in America now, that you were able to start to put faces on people that you didn't know anything about, starting to know the stories and to humanize them. But Hannah Shee Skeffington, when she goes to America, she's also a widow in that sense that Frank Shee Skeffington is murdered during the Rising. And they really, the Americans hone in on this. And there are a lot of photos of Hannah with her son, Owen. She says she particularly disliked what she called the sob stories, but she realized that she had to go along with them because that visual image was so important. So although she was there really as a propagandist to bring forward the message of what was happening and why the Easter Rising had taken place and what people wanted, what the Irish now wanted America to do in terms of supporting the rights of Ireland as a small nation, she still had to, in a sense, play the two roles, the bereaved widow as well as the Republican propagandist. I think it was really important. And I think later on, women see that more and more increasingly. So, for example, another example is Maud Gonne and Charlotte Despard. You see so many photos of them during the time of the Black and Tan. So, for example, the sack of Balbriggan in September 21, they go there, but they actually bring a press photographer with them, Hogan, and he takes photographs of them. And Maud Gonne is able to capitalize on her on the fame that she used to have. And those photos go around the world. And they're also used by the American Commission on Conditions in Ireland when it's taking its hearings. The British government don't allow the commissioners to go to Ireland. So they're then reliant on people like Maud Gonne, who has had the foresight to get those photographs taken at the time when really the buildings are still smouldering. And those are then included in reports on what is happening to Ireland to convince a global audience that the British role in Ireland is really one of an oppressor and that the role of the Black and Tans in particular is something to be deeply ashamed of and that the war needs to end.
Well, I have to say, as a history magazine editor, I am eternally grateful to both Maud Gonne and Charlotte Despard for hiring a photographer in actually getting these shots, you know, because they're used again and again. Dara, can I go back to you? How important was the Irish diaspora in all of this? Because you're talking about a population worldwide.
I think the Irish diaspora as a force as a dynamic really comes into its own from 1919. Again, I go back to this point that the Irish question has been taken out of the context of Westminster and an internal United Kingdom issue, and Irish nationalists have created a global platform by which this might be discussed. So Irish nationalists around the world from 1919 become a lever potentially to negotiate Irish constitutional issues for the first time in many years. There are a couple of ways to think about this. We can think about diaspora activists who were neither Irish born nor Irish elected. And in many ways, I think we're somewhat straight, kept into the straitjacket commemoratively by this idea of Dáil Éireann and so on. But many Irish nationalists around the world were not elected in 1918, did not represent Irish constituencies, but were nonetheless very active and very successful. And a very good example of that is Catherine Hughes, who was, she described herself as a once upon a time Canadian. She was active in Washington, D.C. She supplied congressmen with propaganda on behalf of the Irish National Bureau. She thereafter accompanied De Valera on his tour of the Deep South. She set up the Self-Determination League in Canada, and she was then deployed by De Valera to Australia and New Zealand to set up the Irish Self-Determination Leagues in those countries. So you've got people like that who have no, democratic basis in terms of being elected to kind of carry out this work for Ireland, but did so nonetheless. And I think we also need to think about this idea of the global Irish diaspora as we would think of it today, this, this global Ireland brand, if you will. Irish nationalists in Dublin and elsewhere conceived of this as a counterweight to the British Empire. This idea that there were millions of Irish men and women around the world who could agitate for Irish nationalism and could essentially form a global network to try and offset the power and influence of the British Empire then at its height. And one of the ways which they tried to do that, again, going back to this idea of marketing, branding, image making, was this idea of the Irish Race Convention. And it's no surprise that we see what were called Irish Race Conventions held successively in New York in 1918, followed by Philadelphia in February 1919, followed by Melbourne in 1919, Buenos Aires in 1921, and then the Irish Race Congress, which we might come on to later, in Paris in January 1922. And I would argue that the Irish Race Convention, the idea of the Irish race, suggests a diasporic identity, a global footprint, if you will. But it also suggests that there were connections, that the fact that these events happening all over the world, across the globe in two different hemispheres, were almost speaking to each other. And we do have examples, for example, of the Irish Race Convention sending resolutions to the Irish Race Convention in Philadelphia, sending resolutions to the Irish Race Convention in Melbourne, and so on and so forth. And this was all the act of propaganda on a global scale, demonstrating to British policymakers, but also to other political leaders in the United States in particular, that the Irish were a global force to be reckoned with and that the Irish question was now a global question.
Now, I want to go back to Morris. In this propaganda campaign by Irish nationalists, what was their approach to the international press?
Yeah, so they... To go back to what I was saying earlier about their awareness of news and the importance of news as now a currency of politics, really. And I was, when Kira was talking about the newsreels there, and it occurred to me just that, just a little example of people of that generation's awareness of the news is that after the attempted assassination of Lord French at the end of 1919, when Dan Breen and the others went on the run in Dublin, while they were trying to lay low, they went into a cinema and watched a newsreel account of the assassination that they'd perpetrated. So even though, for instance, that might have obviously been presented in the newsreel in a sympathetic manner to the Crown and to Lord French, the very fact that they knew that they were actually making history and being in the newsreels and were able to watch themselves or had a consciousness to watch themselves was very important. So from the start, they knew that trying to get correspondence to Ireland was key to this. And Desmond Fitzgerald went to London to canvass as many foreign correspondents as possible. And so you see people from all directions coming to Ireland. Obviously, the British press is very important. Come on to that in a minute. American press is important. But you see Norwegians, Finns, French press people coming to Ireland. And so Ireland becomes, at this point, in a way, it's a little kind of mini version of what Spain became in the 1930s, the Spanish Civil War. In other words, it attracts a lot of international attention. And, of course, for major world events, that the international press is there, a consensus develops about what the narrative is. And the consensus that developed in Ireland was that the narrative was British oppression of Ireland, that the Britain had, having fought a war on behalf of civilization against the barbarism of the Germans, having fought a war on behalf of small nations, was now oppressing a small nation. And despite all the propaganda learning that the British had undergone during the First World War, they just let the war, the narrative of the war in Ireland, escape them. And they were unable to make sure that when correspondence came to Ireland, that it was official, i.e. British sources that they went to. And in a way, on many levels, the sources of giving an account of what was going on in Ireland, provided by people like Desmond Fitzgerald, provided by people like Erskine Childers, and then all sorts of other writers and others in almost in a periphery role, they were far more impressive as sources for these visiting correspondents than the people who were in Dublin Castle.
Now, why was that, Morris? I'm thinking of the Irish Bulletin in particular. Just talk to us a little bit about that, because they were producing what might be called factual propaganda. Just explain what you mean by that.
Yeah, well, that was not... This is one of the things that the British discovered during the war and after the war. Sir Gilbert Parker, who was a key figure in the British propaganda effort, and he said one of the reasons it was such a success was because they used the objective language of news rather than crude propaganda. And the Daily Mail is central to a lot of this, because you have the commander of British force in Ireland wanting a Lord Northcliffe to take over their propaganda campaign. And instead, they got this guy called Basil Clark, who had been an official war correspondent during the First World War, as an official war correspondent, conforming completely to the censorship. He worked for the Daily Mail. He came over to Dublin and he tried very hard to point out the same thing, that actually trying to make the news was a far more important objective than putting out, in a way, argumentative rhetoric about what was going on in Ireland. And this is exactly what the Irish propagandists realised. And that's why the Irish Bulletin presented itself as a fact sheet, as an unadorned, objective. And again, this is the moment when objectivity becomes a very important feature or aim or ideal of journalism. The Irish Bulletin set out, rather than flowery or rhetorical denunciations of British rule, it set out accounts of things that had happened. And so it was an attempt to say to the press, to the visiting press, here's the news, not here's our point of view, here's the news. And it tried to replicate as much as possible what an objective, quote unquote, objective piece of newspaper would look like.
Now, Ciara, how does that contrast with the approach of, say, British newsreel propaganda in relation to Ireland? And I'd probably instance like, say, the burning of Cork or Bloody Sunday, November 1920.
Well, what's really interesting about British newsreel coverage of Ireland is what is left out. So there are editorial decisions made on what stories should be covered and which it might be better to ignore. And an example of that is the burning of Cork. So at this stage, of course, newsreels are silent. There are intertitles describing the action on the screen. So the intertitle for this item opens with Ireland's agony, mystery fire in Cork. So, of course, we know that this wasn't a mystery to Cork's residents, who witnessed British forces setting the city alight and even preventing firefighters from tackling the blaze. But the images shot in the aftermath in the days after the fire show the damage done to the city. They show firefighters on screen, but there's no sense of explanation as to what has happened or the perpetrators of the attack. Similarly, there was no coverage of the attack on Croke Park on Bloody Sunday, but the newsreels did report on the funerals of the British officers shot on the orders of Collins that morning. So you can see very clear editorial decisions on what should be covered in terms of Irish events at this stage. And really, in many ways, British newsreels constructed Irish Republicans as the problem and were very unwilling to admit that there had been any misdemeanors by the Black and Tans, for example. So there's a clearer kind of pattern, I suppose, of censorship here. And part of this was due to the fact that newsreels were exhibited in the collective setting of the cinema. So it was thought that patrons of the cinema would be very susceptible to the news that was conveyed to them through the cinema because they were in a group. And also because not everyone could read, the literate patrons tended to read out the intertitles for those around them. And then there could be very vocal responses, boos and cheers and so on. So any criticism of the British military, it was felt that that should probably be avoided in this collective setting of the cinema. And obviously that tapped into a broader pro-British agenda in the newsreels at the time.
Now, Ciara, you've mentioned an interesting case where women were the subject of British propaganda. Just talk to us about that, talking about the sidelights on Sinn Féin.
Yes, so this is a fascinating item. And again, the intertitle gives us a great clue as to the tone of the item. So the intertitle opens by saying, May Connolly, who was kicked and had her hair shorn for the crime of speaking to the black and tans. And the word crime is in inverted commas. So there's a judgmental tone to this particular item. And it's showing how the Irish will commit violence against each other. And this is a very useful way of condemning the Irish. And it taps into, again, a broader strategy of representing the Irish as inherently violent. And so we see this woman with her shorn hair depicted, but she's very much utilized as an anti-Irish figure in terms of showing what has happened to her as anti-Irish propaganda. But I mean, rereading this material 100 years later, it's really significant because we start to see some of the research that's being done more recently on the violence perpetrated against women during this period by both the Irish and the British forces. So there's a sense that this material can be really potent when it's looked at from a contemporary perspective. And it's interesting that the IFI have digitized a lot of this material and made it accessible on their player, but they've added very significant context around these items to explain how they were presented at the time and some of the issues and problems associated with going back to them and looking at them as contemporary audiences. So this material has a lot to say to us as modern audiences about what was happening during the revolutionary period, what audiences were shown about these events, and crucially, what was absent from many of these cinematic representations.
Margaret, do you want to come in on that? Because it strikes me then that the use of women is a kind of a double-edged sword. I mean, thinking of the demonization of, you know, so-called separation women and so forth. Any comment on that?
I mean, it was a time which we now call was also a war on women. So certainly there were attacks on women who fraternized with Crown forces. And the Irish Citizen had an editorial saying that they hoped that Republicans would never resort to doing the same. And, you know, obviously the Irish Citizen took a very strong feminist line on that, but its press gets smashed up by the Black and Tans in 1920. So it's not a vehicle then for us to continue to hear a feminist point of view on that. But Hanashi Skeffington does compile a report on what she calls a statement of atrocities on women in Ireland, and she is partly to give to the Labour Commission on Ireland. And there is a global network of former suffragists, if you like, who are very acutely aware, I think, that women are suffering in this war in a number of different ways. But one of the things that they are very conscious about is that although women are sexually violated, very few of them will come forward to talk about that. And if they do, it's on conditions of anonymity. And you get that very strongly in Hannah's very lengthy statement talking about what has happened to women and the difficulties. And we're finding more of that now through archival research on mental homes, for example, where women ended up having been raped and suffered mentally from that, or from families putting forward through the pension collections some recompense for what happened to their daughter. But women like Emmeline Pethick Lawrence, for example, who'd been a leading suffrage figure in England, who was also a pacifist and a Labour Party member. She comes over on a fact-finding mission and women help her. She brings back information. Jane Addams in America, again, a very leading suffrage figure. She's one of the members of the American Commission on Conditions in Ireland. Muriel McSweeney, when she's giving her evidence, she talks about what happens to some of the women. For example, Ellen Quinn, who's shot dead sitting on a wall holding her child, and she's pregnant. And there are other women like that. So that there is evidence there, but it's been a question of looking for the evidence and also having the sensitivity to understand how difficult it is to bring it forward, because a lot of it is extremely difficult. And I find it interesting looking at the newspapers. If you put in, say, a search for hair cutting, that really what you will find is the women who've been attacked for fraternizing with Crown forces. It seems that their attackers get brought to court, whereas the Crown forces who've attacked women, you don't hear very much about that. We have to find other sources of unearthing that information.
So just moving on to a slightly different topic, Maurice, how did Irish revolutionists situate themselves in wider debates like imperialism, self-determination, liberalism, and crucially, whiteness?
Yeah, so I think this is a crucial question because one of the big successes, the reason Irish propaganda worked was because they were able to make a master narrative. And in a way, you can see them doing so well what, in a way, Britain had tried to do in the First World War. Britain tried to, in the First World War, had a master narrative that the war was a war of civilization against the barbarism of the Germans, a war for small nations, etc. And in Ireland, they were able to present a universal narrative. I was just reading recently, actually, a book published by the anthropologist Jonathan Evershed about the role of the commemoration of the Somme in Northern Ireland. And one of his, he interviewed various loyalists, and one of his interviewees said, talked at one point about how the Somme and commemoration of the Somme, the Battle of the Somme, gave loyalism a kind of universal remembrance, connected them into a much bigger remembrance, which was of the First World War. And then he said, he contrasted how loyalists had failed to do this with how the Republicans had been so successful at making their struggle part of a bigger story. And as he said, it includes everything from Martin Luther King to Gandhi. And again, this goes back to the revolutionary period when they were really successful at doing that. So number one, they connected themselves into debates about it among liberals in Britain, which were in favor of self-determination, in favor of various nationalism, usually in Europe, not necessarily in Ireland. But remember, Home Rule had a big constituency of liberal opinion in Britain. And so a lot of the journalists coming over from papers like The Times, The Manchester Guardian, and The Daily News would have been predisposed to the idea that Ireland should have some form of self-rule. And then that, the idea of self-determination, connected them also into anti-imperialist struggles. So we have India, in a book, A Bit of Freedom, you have an Egyptian nationalist living in London coming to Ireland to see what's going on, partly with a view to kind of transposing some of that back to Egypt. So they connect to a lot of anti-imperialist nationalisms. But then they hit a problem. And Dara's mentioned the race conventions, etc. And part of the problem they hit is that at this time, just after the First World War and at the time of the Versailles Peace Agreement, the idea of race is undergoing a change. So that in the United States especially, there's a big idea that somehow that the world now is really divided between white people and the rest. And so up to then, you could have the German race and the Irish race and the Bulgarian race all making their case. But actually, in the United States especially, there was this idea that there was the white world, the white civilized world, and the rest. And of course, this is reflected in the way that the Versailles Peace Conference proceeded, in which there was one set of arrangements for the white civilized world, and there was another set of arrangements, the mandates, for people not considered yet civilized enough. And so Ireland, the Irish appeal, for instance, to people like Marcus Garvey, black nationalism in the United States, that worked. But then when De Valera on his tour had to go to the southern United States, he had to conjure up this idea of Ireland as the last white nation in slavery. And indeed, that was echoed as well by Sean T. O'Kelly. He wrote to the Pope pointing out that Ireland was the last white nation in slavery. Some of the polemical pieces that Erskine Childress wrote drew on the same idea. And so in the kind of post-war settlement that was emerging, Ireland, or the Irish revolutionaries, although they wanted to appeal across, especially across the world and across anti-imperialist movements, they found themselves having to play this card, or realizing that they had a card, which was their whiteness. And indeed, there's a comment by J.L. Hammond, who was a British journalist in Ireland, who said that one of the best interpretations of what was going on in Ireland during the worst of the Black and Tan period was a French journalist who said that Britain was trying to suppress a nation that was just as good as the rest of the world by methods that they use for the Berbers. And actually, that I think that plays a big role. The fact that the Irish were whites plays a big role in all sorts of international thinking, but also British thinking about what's going on in Ireland.
So in a sense, you know, they're hunting with the hare and running with the hounds to some extent. Dara, can I bring you in? Because this came up at the Irish Race Congress, which I'll come on to in a second, right? And there's a very interesting quote. Now, readers be warned, it's a slightly un-PC quote. Dara, could you just give me that? Because this really sums up the dilemma and the contradictions of this whole situation. Just give me the context of this quote.
So the quote itself from the Race Congress comes from Harry Boland, who, of course, spent, 18 months, almost 2 years in the United States before De Valera even arrived, or while De Valera was there. And he says, "We've got every race in the world in the American Association for the Recognition of the Irish Republic." And he goes on to say, "We've got Chinese, Jews, Turks, Armenians, Russians," and he uses the term darkies. He goes on to say, "So that whoever is appointed on that committee, I want them to bear in mind that some of the people of these races were our best friends," unquote. So that's Harry Boland, who, again, had spent considerable time in the United States, traveled and traversed that continent. And I think in many ways it suggests, kind of going back to what Morris was saying, is that there are kind of ideological tensions internationally in relation to how Irish Republicans present themselves and how they are perceived. So in the United States, there's certainly a constituency by which they represent themselves as a white nation. And as Morris stated, De Valera in Alabama says Ireland's the only white nation still in chains. There again, he, of course, most famously represents himself as this kind of at the vanguard of this anti-colonial movement, wearing the kind of Native American headdress at the Chippewa Reservation in Wisconsin in late 1919. And again, that kind of is a visual image which has gone around the world then and since. So there are kind of inherent tensions there within the Republican movement. I think Europe and the British imperial world heighten or sharpen those kind of twin peaks, if you will. If you look at, for example, in Europe itself, Irish nationalists are engaging actively with might call the dark side of kind of internationalism at this time. I mean, for example, they're sending the copies of the Irish Bulletin to Benito Mussolini, the leader of the emerging fascist movement, who is willingly publishing them reports on Ireland in his newspaper of record, Il Popolo d'Italia, alongside columns which are evidently fascist, authoritarian, anti-democratic, and racist. So Irish news is being juxtaposed with kind of these wider currents of ideological extremism in Europe. And then there's also then the idea of Ireland being this leader or part of this wider anti-colonial moment. And again, you've got Irish nationalists working alongside someone like Saad Zaghloul, the leader of the Egyptian Waft movement, in terms of self-determination and opposition to the British Empire. And I think also it's important to bear in mind, and this goes back to something that Margaret was speaking on, and the idea of women and their agency within the revolutionary movement. It's actually in Europe and perhaps the wider world that Irish nationalist women engage most clearly and most visibly in terms of internationalism. For example, someone like Nancy Weiss-Power, who is the Dáil representative in Berlin in 1921, works alongside Egyptian, Indian, Persian activists. And quite interestingly, someone like Nancy Weiss-Power, but others as well, they work alongside, for example, non-Irish born intellectuals. Her doctoral supervisor, Professor Julius Bocorni at the University in Berlin, essentially co-authored a German version of the Irish Bulletin. So there's an element of kind of delegating the idea of Irish propaganda to non-Irish born activists. And in some cases, as in the case of Mussolini in Italy, also JBM Herzog, the leader of the Afrikaans National Party in South Africa, that also kind of moves the Irish question out of this idea of a virtuous issue of global import into the more murky issues of race, internationalism, and anti-colonialism.
Now, another thing, of course, which muddies the waters, and maybe, Maurice, I'll go to you on this, because all of you have used this term, a grand narrative, that this nationalist grand narrative was created, which had a potency, not just in Ireland, but worldwide. But, of course, the treaty then is signed, Maurice, in December 1921, and I'm assuming that means there's no longer a single hymn sheet. So how does that alter matters?
Yeah, so this is where the grand narrative, the success of the grand narrative, in a way, comes back, rebounds, because essentially, broadly, I would say, both the British liberal press and an international press bossed the idea, the grand narrative of a people struggling for their nationhood. But I think, judging from what happens once the Civil War begins, I think it's a very puzzling event for foreign observers. First of all, interest in Ireland diminishes because, to all intents and purposes, it's over, there's a treaty, there's a settlement, Ireland has some kind of independence as far as people abroad are concerned. And then you have, of course, as you mentioned, Tommy, the movement splits. So in terms of propagandists, they go two different ways, yeah? But also, I think, in terms of the story that people abroad understood, which was this country was being oppressed and seeking its independence, they now look and think, well, they have their independence. In other words, the finer points of the treaty debated in the Dáil, I don't think really cut through. They have their independence. What is this? What's going on in Ireland now? What's this civil war really about? And so I think there then be a worry among the provisional government that takes over after the treaty. There's a worry that the civil war will now portray Ireland internationally as a kind of failed state. And there's Kevin O'Higgins at one point railing against the Republicans and the civil war, talks about Ireland will be classed with the Mexican, as he put it. And so that's a synonym for a revolution that went on for years and Mexico becomes a kind of failed state. And so there is a sense, again, connected to this new global regime that comes out of the Versailles Peace Conference, that Ireland will slip down the rankings, so to speak, and appear, because of the civil war and because of all the chaos that's going on, will appear to be one of those countries that can't govern themselves and will not be living up to the white man's idea of civilization. And that's a big fear among in the government during the Civil War.
Now, Ciara, just going back to the treaty, Ciara, how is the treaty depicted in newsreels?
Well, the newsreels endorsed the signing of the treaty with great optimism, and they ultimately would be more sympathetic to the pro-treaty stance during the Civil War. But there's a really striking item called Peace Council at the Palace, which reports the King's reaction to the signing of the treaty, stating, "Splendid news, says the King, his smile reflects the Irish sunshine." So it's really bombastic in its optimism. And there's no sense here of the protracted or difficult nature of the negotiations. There's even, in fact, a sense of camaraderie suggested between the British and Irish delegates who are depicted alongside the King. And then we see shots of the Irish delegates on their own, talking together, and the film ends on images of Michael Collins smiling and laughing, when we know, of course, he felt that he'd signed his own death warrant, and 8 months later the newsreels would be reporting on his funeral. But interestingly, after the signing of the treaty, the newsreels become much more sympathetic of Collins, because he is seen as a pro-treaty signatory, and therefore he is deemed to be a kind of safer in comparison with someone like De Valera, for example. So Collins and Griffith are shown returning to Ireland after signing the treaty, and we are told that they are wildly welcomed home. We see Collins speaking to huge crowds with great passion. De Valera, on the other hand, is described as the irreconcilable because of his anti-treaty stance. And one issue even states that Irish peace is imperiled by extremists, and De Valera is the extremist that's being depicted here. So this pattern, interestingly, would continue throughout the political career of De Valera. So while Collins death and funeral are conveyed with great respect in the newsreels. De Valera continues to be regarded with suspicion. He's kind of a shadowy, untrustworthy figure in the newsreels. And this would continue in the following decades, right up to the Second World War, where they started to call him a dictator. So there's a very interesting approach in terms of Collins and De Valera and how they are depicted in the newsreels at this stage.
Now, Margaret, I just want to go to you because most of the women, say, in the Dáil were anti-treaty, and this leads to a proliferation of, you know, anti-woman propaganda. They're described as furies. And De Valera, who Ciara referred to, he even refers to them as unmanageable revolutionaries, which, of course, was the title of your seminal book back in the 1980s. Just talk to us a little bit about that. So the whole thing rebounds on women, it seems to me.
All of the six women in the Dáil are against the treaty, and they, you know, in varying degrees of fluency describe, you know, why. I mean, Mrs. Pierce says that her sons, Patrick and Willie, wouldn't have, they wanted a republic, and she's very clear about that. She doesn't articulate it in any great detail, but all of the women do try. And they come back to the proclamation of the Republic in 1916 and the promises there that had been made for a new society. And what they're saying is the treaty doesn't live up to that. And so I think that the women are coming, are approaching the treaty from a different point of view than men. They're coming points of view where only women over 30, for example, have got the vote. And women and public life is still not opened up to women. And so one of the interesting things is after the treaty debate, a vote has been taken in the Dáil that Kate O'Callaghan then puts forward a motion for women between the ages of 21 to 30, having the vote before the treaty is voted on the very understandable argument that it isn't democratic to vote on something so fundamental when the younger generation and the generation who have been fighting this war will not have a say in it. And that is defeated. And it's basically defeated on pro and against treaty points of view. And at the same time, you've got a very united suffrage delegations trying externally to convince the various TDs to vote in favour of it. Arthur Griffith famously says that if they do that, it will torpedo the treaty, because he knows perfectly well that it's also the younger men who have turned 21, who are not on the electoral register, who don't have a chance of voting. The treaty wouldn't have gone forward if they had changed the electoral register before the referendum. And Hanashi Skeffington, writing to an American friend, says that the majority of women are against the treaty, and as a consequence, there's great bitterness against us just now. And she says, it's all the people who have a stake in the country. It's the clergy, the press, and those with property who want it. And we're in for a period of reaction in the future. And she was absolutely right about that. And so when we have the treaty, and then in 1924, we have the appearance of P.S. O'Hegarty's book, The Victory of Sinn Féin, and his very famous chapter, The Furies, that you've referenced there, Tommy. What he says is just outrageous. Things like mother's milk, their mother's milk was blackened to make gunpowder. Women are completely blamed for what had happened. And it's an easy way, isn't it, for men to just avoid any culpability by putting the blame on women. The fact there were only six women in the Dáil doesn't make any difference. They're the ones who seem to have caused the civil war. And you get that whole anti-woman propaganda. So the first reaction of the Dáil in 1924 is the Juries Bill. So whereas in the War of Independence, there had been so much made of the fact that women were integral parts of the Republican court, you couldn't try a woman if you didn't have a woman within the court system. This was supposed to be a part of the New Ireland. Within 2 years, women are now no longer part of the jury system and no longer there to be tried by their peers. And that leads to that period of reaction when women are basically removed from aspects of the labour force. And we end up then later on with De Valera's Constitution 37. And he talks about, as you say, women has having been the boldest and most unmanageable revolutionaries. So from both sides of the treaty, men are in agreement on one thing, which is that they don't particularly want women in political life.
We will come back to that, Margaret. We'll be looking at the treaty and the Civil War, of course, in future hedge schools. Dara, I'm just keeping an eye on the time here. I'm going to have to give the last word to you. Can you just go back and just talk to us a little bit about the Irish Race Congress held in early 1922? Because its proceedings seem to sum up a lot of the difficulties that now faced the movement following the signing of the treaty.
That's very true. I think the Irish Race Congress has been a lost moment in Irish history, both contemporarily speaking and historically. In terms of the latter, it's been kind of conceived as basically a kind of an after show to the Anglo-Irish Treaty debates, which took place in Dublin, of course, as has been mentioned. But if you look through the luminous proceedings of the Irish Race Congress held in the Salle des Fêtes in Paris between 21st and the 28th of January 1922, as you kind of suggest, Tom, you see a whole range of perspectives, which essentially have been what we've been talking about to date, come to the fore in relation to Ireland's place in the world, race, the role of women, ethnicity, and so on. And it kind of goes back to this idea that Morris has brought forward, this idea of the grand narrative essentially comes undone over this 7-day period in which 100 nationalists from 20 countries are descending in Paris, among them people like Eamon de Valera, Owen McNeill. And these kind of rapturous debates, essentially, I would argue, mark the second series of Anglo-Irish treaty debates, in the sense of you have diaspora nationalists from all over the world discussing and debating and disagreeing, most fundamentally, the kind of controversial issues of race and so on, notwithstanding the Anglo-Irish treaty. But I think, and this goes back to my point earlier about marketing and branding and this idea of propaganda, propagandizing this idea of global Ireland. In many ways, we need to think separately about the idea of the Irish Race Convention. As I said, there were race conventions from 1916 onwards in New York, Philadelphia, Melbourne, Buenos Aires, and now Paris. And always been this idea of the global Ireland community coming together, and the Irish race as a term connects everything in its broadest sense. The Irish Race Congress was originally envisaged by South African nationalists in the spring of 1921 as being this diaspora-led initiative, which would not only offer a counterweight to the British Empire, but during the treaty negotiations, serve as a major global lever, if you will, to the British threat of immediate war. And when the Anglo-Irish Treaty is signed and the delegates arrive in Paris over a week after, or a month after the treaty is signed, there is great acrimony and disdain towards the Irish leaders, because the idea is that the Irish Treaty was not referred to the Race Congress. So this idea of the treaty not being referred to Dublin is well worn in Irish history. But to Irish diaspora leaders, the treaty was not referred to New York, to Melbourne, to Buenos Aires. And that becomes the great divider at this Race Congress in Paris in January of 1922, that from their point of view, this idea of the Irish race could have served as a major counterpoint to the British Empire in the signing of the Anglo-Irish Treaty, and that they were not given the opportunity not only to debate the merits of the treaty, but to offer a political counterweight to the threat of the British Empire. And in many respects, the Irish Race Congress, therefore, I think, is a lost moment in time, not only to Irish nationalists, but to Irish historians, to better understand how Irish nationalism was propagandized around the world during the Irish Revolution.
Okay, Dara, we're going to leave it there. And of course, Dara, you can find out more about the Irish Race Congress in our next History Ireland special supplement, The Split from Treaty to Civil War, 1921 to 1923. And Dara is one of our hardworking commissioning editors on that. Ciara, of course, has an article in that as well on how the treaty and civil war were depicted in film. Just to say, our next hedge school will be Fingal in the Revolutionary Decade, and that will be posted at the end of this month. So just like to thank our speakers here today, Ciara Chambers, Dara Gannon, Maurice Walsh, and Margaret Ward. And thank you, the listener, for tuning in, and I hope you'll join us for the next hedge school. Thank you very much.
Brand. Brand new luxury apartments. If you're in the market, listen. Brand new luxury apartments. Champion has a new property, River Park of Dublin, which is a mile south of Dublin. Location is everything. Spacious 1, 2, and 3 bedroom homes, designer finishes, resort style amenities, exceptional customer service. That's Champion. Champion's brand new luxury apartments, River Park of Dublin. Now do something about it. Visit livewithchampion.com. Livewithchampion.com.
At KFC, everyday value meets big flavor. That means getting 6 crispy pieces of delicious dark meat drums and thighs, plus 4 biscuits, all for just $10 with our Dine and Dash deal. All that juicy, original recipe chicken for only 10 bucks every day. Now that's finger-licking good. Hurry into KFC and taste the deal we're cooking up. Limited time only. Prices and participation may vary. While supplies last, tax, tip, and fees extra. Not available on third-party ordering platforms.
Time is precious, and so are our pets. So time with our pets is extra precious. That's why we started Dutch. Dutch provides 24/7 access to licensed vets with unlimited virtual visits and follow-ups for up to 5 pets. You can message a vet at any time and schedule a video visit the same day. Our vets can even prescribe medication for many ailments, and shipping is always free. With Dutch, you'll get more time with your pets and year-round peace of mind when it comes to their vet care.